Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and coming up later on the show, we'll take a listen to the popular but disturbing songs that celebrate some of Mexico's most dangerous drug lords. The songs are called Narco Corridos, and they are just one part of a recent documentary called Narco Cultura that takes a multifaceted look at the Mexican drug war. We'll talk with the film's director. Plus live music from the band Speedy Ortiz, a group that's garnered more than a few positive comparisons to 90s alternative bands like Pavement or Archers of Loaf or Helium. But let's begin by going back a decade further, back to the 1980s. That's when our first guest's career started out with the pop sounds of New Wave. Evolved to something much harder and darker. Hard to believe that's even the same band, but it is. Ministry started with a very high-gloss new wave sound, but then became one of the defining bands in the industrial music movement. Frontman Al Jorgensen has been through it all, and he tells it all in a recent memoir called Ministry, The Lost Gospels According to Al Jorgensen. He joins me now from member station KTEP in El Paso, Texas. Al Jorgensen, thanks for joining us.
Hey, John, what's up?
Well, I have to say I'm exhausted from reading your book. I don't know how you are still standing. I mean,
I have no idea either. There was one theory put forth by a journalist recently that said, I have a lot of friends that have died, you know, prematurely, mm-hmm. and a lot of friends that have died of natural causes and this and that, and I've lost a lot of people over the years, and this journalist basically recommended to me that God keeps me around because I amuse him. So he keeps giving me cat lives. I'm on three. I've got six to go. I don't want to hit nine. Trust me. I don't want to be a cat. I'll settle at three, and I'll leave it at that.
So you're referring to the three times that you have been clinically dead.
Yes, clinically dead.
There is so much drug use in this story, even by rock and roll standards, that I have to ask you, Al, how much do you actually remember?
Well, that was my whole point of the preface of the book, was if you remember the 90s, you probably weren't there.
Right.
So how I did this book was I had a long and trusted friend that used to work at MTV, John Wiederhorn, mm-hmm. who's interviewed me, 15 times or something. And I kind of trusted him with it, you know. So basically, my wife just said, look, every time we go to a party or a social event, you tell the same old drunken, drugged out stories about rock and roll and this and that. Why don't you just put it down in the book and then hand out a pamphlet at the beginning of each social event, and then just sit in the corner and be quiet and drink your vodka, right? Instead of just reliving all these crazy stories. So I took her advice. We got John Wiederhorn to come out. We'd spend a week completely hammered and with tape recorder rolling, and then he'd spend the next 4 weeks doing due diligence, getting witnesses and things to make sure it wasn't a figment of my imagination, or I wasn't making it up, or it wasn't BS. And he would do his due diligence. And after he'd be done with that, he goes, okay, these pretty much check out. And then he had enough where he turned it over to the publisher, and then they turn it over to their lawyers for the next 6 weeks of due diligence of harassing these people.
Yeah.
Going, is this what really happened? So as far as whether I remember it correctly or not, apparently I did a pretty good job because, you know, a lot of due diligence has gone into this. And, you know, yeah, I remember, you know, some bits very clearly and some bits not so much.
Well, the book is full of surprises. You were born in Cuba, and you are related to Leo Brower, the great Cuban composer and guitarist, right?
I can't believe you know that name. That is so awesome. You are already on my Christmas card list just for knowing Leo Brower and what a genius he was.
Yeah.
That's my great uncle. That's my grandfather's brother. And I got to meet him when he was in his late 80s, when Cuba let him tour the United States, and I got to meet him in Chicago, and it was one of the greatest thrills of my life. Not only that, my great-great-great-grandfather was the national composer of Spain, so I've got some music in my blood, I don't know, either music or tequila, something, I don't know. Something's now, working.
He is Al Jourgensen, frontman for the influential band Ministry and several other bands as well, and author of the new memoir Ministry, The Lost Gospels, according to Al Jourgensen. So, as I mentioned, lots of surprises, almost every page. One of them being that when you first started making music, you were doing these kind of odd, what sound to be like very experimental things at a college in Chicago. It almost sounds like you were doing almost avant-garde classical music.
Well, I wouldn't call it classical, but yes, avant-garde for sure. Moog and ARP synthesizers had just come out. The Art Institute of Chicago wanted to start delving into that, and so they, because my girlfriend at the time was going there and, you know, straight A student at the Art Institute, she talked them into giving me this little room at the bottom of the Art Institute with these couple like really kind of crappy 1950s like Moog and ARP synthesizers, and told me to start a sound department. And the stuff I was doing then was very Stockhausen. I don't know if you know Stockhausen.
I do know Stockhausen, you know, and that's why I mentioned classical, because, you know, that's the world he came from.
Right, exactly. You know, and of course, you know, listening to Leo, my great uncle, you know, obviously that came into fruition, but you know, we were just plugging things in and hoping for the best. Sometimes the speakers would blow up. Sometimes it would make a cool sound, and that's how I got my start before I got into all this like rock and roll, you know, circus and pony thing that's going on now. So,
and when you did make the move into rock and roll, I mean, having had this experience with synthesizers and stuff, did that in? I mean, the early days of Ministry is a completely different band from what it would later become, and it's much more keyboard driven than guitar driven, it seems.
Well, you know, I mean, I learned guitar at the age of 8 from my grandfather, so I knew the basic chords. I've never considered myself a great guitar player or even a good guitar player. I'm functional, but I do know what I want within the context of the song. So guitar was always a part of it, but the synthesizer thing, until it got taken over by my first record contract by Clive Davis and all these other powers that be that wanted to make me the next you know, like a white pop star.
Mm-hmm.
It was really gross taking my knowledge of experimenting with these instruments and turning it into a completely banal pop format, which is what I really disagree with about my early stuff, was I was under the control and under the contract of people that wanted to make me something that I didn't want to be. So I don't even count those records on my resume of 40 albums or whatever I have. I don't even count those on there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some of those songs, you know, I remember hearing like Work for Love and Every Day is Halloween on the radio. But even...
Yeah, that was all written by Clive Davis. I mean... Literally. I mean, he would. I was recording in London, and he would call me up and sing me a chorus or a verse and then provide backup singers and, you know, and all this stuff. It's like pretty much like trying to do any task with two hands tied behind your back and blindfolded. And I did the best I could. You know, I'm not ashamed of them. Because without them, I mean, there's no regrets. Without them, I wouldn't have taken the course that I took for the next 30 years.
You said you needed full-time help because you're all alone. Said I'd work for nothing at all if I just could take you home. Now you're taking it.
Ministry, a very different band in the early 80s from what it would become even in the late 80s. And my guest is Al Jurgensen on Soundcheck today, the founder and frontman of the band Ministry. His new book is called Ministry, The Lost Gospels, according to Al Jurgensen. So you're in this kind of machine where, you know, you're on Arista, Clive Davis's label. And as you say, you know, they're sort of forcing you in a musical direction you don't want to go in. How did you make the kind of the change when we get to 1988's album, The Land of Rape and Honey?
Yeah, that's two words. That's easy. Lawyers. Two words. Lawyers. Got me out of the Arista contract, and then we started up Wax Trax Records, and we started doing some of the stuff we wanted to do. Like, some of the stuff that was supposed to be on that With Sympathy album wound up on The Land of Rape and Honey, which some people consider one of my seminal works,
mm-hmm.
right? But that stuff was submitted to Arista and immediately rejected. And then Clive would, like, hum songs to me over the song, and that's what I had to do because I was under contract. But those great two words, lawyers, I used to hate them. I actually, I kind of like them now because they've done some good things for me. But mm-hmm. And that set me off on my path after that.
Now, where did the industrial kind of sound come from for you? Were you listening to, like, you know, Throbbing Gristle and Einstürzende Neubauten, or did it go back to the Stockhausen and that sort of thing?
Both. And I got to know, you know, Neubauten personally, you know, as people, and I was living in Berlin mm-hmm. at the time, and of course, and Throbbing Gristle, of course, and Cabaret Voltaire. And then also reading, like, you know, it goes with literature too. I mean, if you're really trying to combine something that's different, you don't just do something that another band has done. You combine it with literature or movies or something that ties in the entire, impetus for your brain to get going. You use a lot of different directions, and I used anything from movies to literature, like whether you say Burroughs or Leary, Bukowski or Ginsberg or whatever. I used that. I incorporated that inside the sound as well, which would be Stockhausen, Neubauten, and Throbbing Gristle. I have no problems like crediting like my predecessors who really set the table for me, but I just tried to include a little bit more. That's all.
The results are on this 1988 record by Ministry called "The Land of Rape and Honey." This song is "Stigmata."
Thank you.
at his ministry.
That's a blast from the past, man.
from 1988, to be precise.
You're making me feel old here, John.
Al Jurgensen's my guest on Soundcheck. We're talking about his band, ministry, his book, Ministry, The Lost Gospels, according to Al Jurgensen, Stigmata from the Land of Rape and Honey. So one of the more interesting sidebars in the book is the chapter where you discuss the various drugs that you were taking for the various records. How were you? I mean, first of all, let me say that in this digital age, people would hear that sound that we were just hearing and think, oh, that's all done, you know, electronically. These were handmade records. You cut and spliced tape while out of your mind on heroin and coke. How did you do that?
Yeah. Well, I guess that's why I'm on your show.
you're going to teach me how to handle a razor blade?
Yeah, not a lot of people were allowed razor blades in my condition, but for some reason I got through that law and was able to slice and dice. Yeah, it was all tape splicing all the way up until, I think, Dark Side of the Spoon was the first time we went digital.
Mm-hmm.
So all those early records, Psalm 69, Land of Rape and Honey, Mine is a Terrible Thing to Taste, all those were done by me literally just doing a boatload of drugs and with a razor blade in my hand and a two-track machine and just splicing up tape. And I learned that from William Burroughs, obviously, doing the book Naked Lunch. I mean, you can't get more splice and dice than that. Biron Gisson, also a French writer, was also doing the same kind of concept. That's what I was saying. I was trying to incorporate a lot of different entertainment value in one song, and not entertainment value, but more of like my passions.
Now, the corollary to that is that as ministry began taking off and selling records and selling out concerts, you were making more money. You talk about at one point getting $750,000 of an advance for one of the records, and yet you still had no money because it was all going to drugs.
No, they had to give us another $750,000. They had to double down on their bet because everything went up our arms or our noses or whatever ingestion procedure happens when you're doing drugs. And, but that was the 90s. The 90s was like the Wild West. The 60s and the 90s were the Wild West of the music industry where just just rampant abuse and enabling and everything else. Things are obviously on a much tighter budget now, mm-hmm. and you have to get things done.
So what have you ever kind of looked back at that period and thought, gee, I wonder what I could have done if I had been, clean back in the 90s?
No, absolutely not. I have there's not a single thing in that book or my albums that I regret, including my first album, because if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't have taken the path that I took now. As far as the book, yeah, I see a lot of jackass moves on my part. I'm not stupid, but would it be different now in the place that I'm at now if I hadn't done it that way then?
Al Jurgensen's with us on Soundcheck from the band Ministry. The book, the memoir, is called Ministry, The Lost Gospels, according to Al Jurgensen. Al, earlier we were talking about your multiple lives. Ministry has had multiple lives and multiple times where you've said, that's it for the group. Now, you guys did get back together a few years ago when you were working on this new album when your longtime friend and collaborator Mike Scascia passed away last December. So will this, in fact, be the final album because Mike's no longer with you?
First of all, I wrote The Last Sucker seriously thinking that would be my last record under the moniker of Ministry because I was having major health issues. When I did get out of the hospital after my ulcer scare, my third death, the first person I called was Mike Scascia because we'd been talking about doing this country record for literally 30 years. At any rate, he came out and we did that record. While doing the country record, you know, in between songs or whatever, or after sessions, we'd jam on some riffs. And I just put them on a shelf. I didn't think anything of it. I just thought it was like, you know, therapeutic or whatever. And then after the Buck Satan record came out, Mikey just kept psycho texting me going, these riffs are really cool. You have to put this out. He talked me into it. So if you like the album, give me all the credit. And if you hate the album, please blame Mikey. All right?
Nice guy, Al Jergensen.
All right.
I'm blame just, my dead friend if you don't yeah, like it.
Right. I'm telling it like it is.
Al, it has been great fun speaking with you on Soundcheck today.
Thank you, John. It's actually not been that painful for me, so I appreciate you.
That's the song Permawar from Ministry's 13th and supposedly final album called From Beer to Eternity. We spoke to Al Jergensen in July of 2013. Up next, a live performance from the band Speedy Ortiz. Stay with us. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Until pretty recently, Speedy Ortiz was just the name of a doomed character in the 80s comic book series Love and Rockets. But last year, Speedy Ortiz took on another meaning when frontwoman Sadie Dupuy and her band released their debut album under that name. Speedy Ortiz's first effort is called Major Arcana, and it's full of wry lyrics, searing guitars, and contorted riffs, and today, we'll get to hear some of it right here in the Soundcheck studio. This song is called Cash Cab from the band Speedy Ortiz.
Thank you.
That is Speedy Ortiz live on Soundcheck with their song Cash Cab. You'll find it on their album Major Arcana, but that a live performance here in the Soundcheck studio. Speedy Ortiz is Sadie Dupuy singing and playing guitar, Matt Robidoux playing guitar, Darrell Firm playing the bass, and Mike Falcone behind our drum kit here in the Soundcheck studio. They are Speedy Ortiz. Guys, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having us here.
So, Cash Cab, there's a TV show by that name where you get into a New York City taxi cab and
Correct.
Lights start blinking and you can win cash prizes. And so, is that the inspiration?
It's very New York City related. The title, yeah.
The cab does
to me
ride
it is.
Around New York City.
Now, Sadie, you are originally from New York, right?
Yeah.
But this is a Western Massachusetts-based band.
Yep. Mike lives in Connecticut. Darrell is now near Boston.
Mm-hmm.
We have to pick one place
to Western Mass
say
is
we're
the
from.
Home base.
So.
Right. So did you guys meet at one of the colleges there?
No. Just know each other from playing in bands and going to shows and being fans of each other's bands.
And how big is the scene there, like in the, the Amherst Five Colleges area?
Over there, it's
pretty
somewhat.
Decent.
It's a really good scene. It's small, which is, I think, has benefits.
I mean, there's for folks who are in the folk circuit, there's Northampton is part
That's
of that.
That's definitely part of it.
Yeah. I wasn't aware of how much of a kind of a rock scene there was, though.
A lot of punk rock.
Really?
Comes from that area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, since I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah. And it was a part of one of the hubs of Riot Grrrl in the '90s.
Yeah.
Well, now, speaking of the 90s, everyone does seem to speak about the 90s when they talk about the sound of
As soon
of
as I said
thing.
It, I was like, oh, no.
Yeah, there
Why did
there
I drop
comes.
That decade?
So all the reviewers mention bands like Pavement and Helium and Liz Phair and stuff. And you guys are a little too young for that to have been in your, kind of like 14, 15, 16-year-old sweet spot. So
you were totally like 14, 15, 16-year-old.
No comment.
I should not say Mike's age.
So Mike is the old man of the band. Is that what you're trying to say?
Are you the elder statesman, Mike?
Sure. I'll claim that.
How did you grow? How did you guys sort of get into these bands, which, came a little bit before your time?
You mean how did we learn about them?
Yeah.
I don't know. Just there was a show on MTV called 120 Minutes,
yeah.
And that was kind of like a big part of what informed me about, obscure bands throughout the 90s, because there was no, I didn't have internet then.
Right.
Some people did, but I did not.
And for you, Sadie?
Some of that as well, watching MTV and listening to the radio and having parents who also were interested in rock music.
Yeah. Right, so you would raid your parents.
I totally stole my dad's CDs.
We're speaking with the members of the band Speedy Ortiz. Now, this next song is so new. Is this right? It's not even titled?
We haven't named it just yet.
There was some tentative titles floating around, but we don't like any of them yet.
I think I wrote down like three options in a notebook that I left at home.
Right.
Okay. Well,
when I go home, I'll call you guys up and say, hey, by the way, that song.
Right.
For the moment, we'll call it the Soundcheck Special.
Ooh.
I love it. Let's go with it.
All right. It's the band Speedy Ortiz. They're playing live here in the Soundcheck studio today. Let's hear this new song.
We'll be right back. so you might escape back to the place where horrors fade away. Till you might escape back to the place where horrors fade away.
New song from the band Speedy Ortiz, so new, not yet titled. Live performance here in the Soundcheck studio from the Western Massachusetts indie rock band. Guys, I know you have a busy slate. I'm really happy you took some time out to join us here on Soundcheck today. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
Speedy Ortiz played for us live in the studio in October of 2013. Up next, we talk with the filmmaker behind the documentary Narcocultura. It's a fascinating look at Mexico's raging drug war through the popular murder ballads that celebrate it. That's next on Soundcheck. At first listen, this music sounds innocent enough, but for those of you who don't speak Spanish, let me translate the line we just heard. With an AK-47 and a bazooka on my shoulder, cross my path and I'll chop your head off. We're bloodthirsty, crazy, and we like to kill. This tune is just one of thousands of narcocorridos, popular Mexican songs that glamorize and celebrate outlaw drug traffickers. Shaul Schwartz is the director of a new documentary film called Narcocultura that examines this genre of music and the Mexican drug war that inspired it. And Shaul Schwartz joins me here in the Soundcheck studio. Welcome.
Thank you, John.
This is a horrifying story on many levels, but in a very subtle way, one of the most shocking scenes in the movie comes very early on where we hear the song we just heard sung by its lead singer as he's bicycling around with his little kid on a little trailer behind the bike, you know, and he's singing as he's bicycling along, and then he turns to the kid and says, sing it.
Right. I think for some of the guys in this scene, it's so engraved so deep in their mind and hearts and souls, if you will, that it seems natural. To them, it's this weird borderline game, almost like a Halloween. Maybe I could be narco for a night, kind of deal. So for Edgar, the corrido singer who sings this to his 2-year-old, you know, it's his song, so I imagine he kind of hums it along during life. But he always on one hand wants to portray this as don't take this too wrongly. Tarantino makes violent movies too. You know, every Sopranos has been out there. So we sing about the cartels, which when you see the movie, it is a little different because the connection is a little bit more straight up to the reality.
Well, the connection is awfully close. And, you know, this is not the first time on Soundcheck that we've discussed narcocorridos. And, you know, it's always reminded me of, like, you know, medieval courts where they would have court composers. And
absolutely. He's a court jester of the cartel, if you will.
So how popular are these narcocorridos?
They're very popular. Their popularity in the U.S. specifically has grown a lot in the last couple of years. And the style of it has changed because narcocorridos go back to bands that today almost seem classical. Tigres del Norte, Chalino Sanchez, these kind of legends that really hinted more of corruption rather than what these corridos of today do, which is really, like you translated the word, strong hitting, binding with a specific cartel, even signing the name of the trafficker that commissioned the cartel,
right.
the song to be written, and controls word by word of what comes out.
Well, and an example of that is in the film, which is called Narcocultura, we hear Edgar talking to, this is one of the American drug runners named Ghost, and he's trying to find out, you know, details of the gun he carries and that sort of stuff, so he can weave that into the song. Listen to this.
Ahora sí, compa Ghost. What do you want me to put in your song? The more stuff you let me know, the more I can make it interesting y más perro sale. Okay. ¿Qué calibre carga?
Una 9mm.
9mm, all right.
Una
R. All right, R.
So he carries a 9mm pistol. You can find him in Oxnard.
And an R-15, which is a machine.
And an R-15. and then, is this the guy we actually see Edgar in a truck singing the song for three guys? Is one of them Ghost?
Yes, it is. So the part we heard is from the studio. It's an initial talk. Ghost approaches, and this is a fairly regular thing that happened. Edgar performed somewhere. Ghost, a person he doesn't know, approaches him after the concert and say, will you write my corrido? They have a phone interview, which is what you just heard. And that phone interview basically tells what he likes, what kind of girls, what kind of guns, a little bit of stories. I did this, I run the drugs, this, I sell this and that. And then Edgar takes all that material and almost like a court jester, like you mentioned, kind of puts it together. That's the first key trade. Then, and you see this in the film, what happened specifically was Ghost, because he was close enough, they meet at a discreet gas station in Hollywood.
Right.
And Edgar kind of rhymes, spits out the word, no music.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, just kind of the lyrics. And Ghost pretty much approves it word by word and hands off a chunk of change.
A wad of $100 bills.
Correct, $4,000. Edgar doesn't like that I mentioned this because he feels that was too little for that.
He says, what, no tip?
Exactly.
Which you think is a joke, and maybe it is, but there's also a kind of edge to it.
Yes, it does. And of course, later that day, he goes home, he puts away the money, and then the next phase begins, which is once the words are approved, you do go ahead and you got paid as a singer, you go ahead and write the song. And it's interesting, this was for a small timer,
right,
out of the U.S. But Edgar writes about different traffickers and bigger ones from Mexico, and there is kind of this game. If you're the songwriter that can hook up with bigger guys, it gives you kind of more street credibility, if
right,
you will.
Right. Edgar is Edgar Quintero. He leads this group called Bucanas de Culiacan, and they are based,
Bucanas de Culiacan. They're based in L.A. The band members are all Mexican-Americans. Edgar is an American. He was born here. His singing, as he says it, is a way to connect his heritage.
Yeah. Now, that heritage, I mean, Narco Corridos has a heritage, the corrido tradition.
Absolutely.
What is that?
Well, it's Norteño regional music. It comes from the border. And it's really ballads, and they didn't even start as narco ballads necessarily, but they did evolve into a lot of narco ballads. And as I said, narco ballads themselves as well and corridos have been around for a long while, but the switch of the violence, and this, Edgar is part of a group called Movimiento Alterada, which is kind of this very hyped up branch of this, and it really kicks off and gets to new scales after the 206 famous Mexican drug war, as it likes to be labeled, where Calderon, the president of Mexico, kind of mobilized.
2006.
2006, yeah. President Calderon of Mexico, the former president, mobilizes the army, and we get a bloodbath that starts,
right,
that is still waging.
Now, you talk about this Movimiento Alterado. One of the guys from that movement is, in your film, quoted as saying something like, maybe we can be the next hip-hop.
Correct.
Is that, you know, I mean, gangster rap, outlaw country, there have been plenty of other examples of bad people being celebrated. Is there something different about these narco-corridos?
I think there is. There's a lot of common and a lot different. In common, as you say, everybody kind of loves to hate that, love an outlaw. And that's similar. But if you look at the beginning of gangster rap, if you look at the Biggies and the Tupacs, they were spitting and rhyming about their struggle, about selling dime bags at a corner while living in the ghetto.
Right.
Edgar doesn't talk about his own struggle. In fact, he looks for the biggest traffickers he can to make folklore heroes out of. And just to, I'm not downsizing the amount of crime, it was Bloods and Crips and the black streets of America related to drug trade, but just to put it in proportion, the Sinaloa cartel, which Edgar kind of directly sings towards, is the biggest crime syndicate in the world. The mm-hmm. DEA estimates that it has 100,000 to a quarter million people on its payroll. It's part of a $50 billion a year industry of supplying the drugs to this country. These guys, its leader, Chapo Guzman, is the most wanted man in the world after the capturing and killing of Bin Laden. These are real players.
And also one of the wealthiest men
in the
world.
He was on Fortune's 100 richest people, which angered a lot of people.
Los antras andan al tiro, también el compa Manuel. El macho anda bien armado, el gobierno anda atrás de él. Todos son comando X, patrullando Culiacán. Protegidos por el M, también el Chapo Guzmán.
So it's not just that these guys have kind of infiltrated the culture to the extent that that 100,000 to quarter million employees includes a lot of government people and police, et cetera, but also that they've inspired songs and films. And at one point in your movie, we see a narco film being
yes.
shot. And there's a crowd gathering around to watch, and when one particular bloody scene ends, it burst into applause. I mean, it seems to really have seeped into their pop culture.
It is totally in their pop culture. Look, for the thing is that for a lot of Mexicans, I think for Americans, we've had this thing going on for so long, and we hear about this drug war for 30 years, and we kind of a little bit stick our head in the sand. But you have to understand, in Mexico, what we've seen since 206 has shaken the ground so violently and so crazily that everything's changed. It's in the media every day. It's in the gossip. It's in crazy popular blogs like Blog del Narco, which are so much more than blogs now. They are able to influence actual politics and who stays in power and who doesn't. That it's not surprising to me to see young teenage girls saying, I'd like to date a narco. I'd like to live with one.
A mí sí me gustaría ser la novia de un narcotraficante porque es una forma de vida, no es nada malo. Tal vez sí es algo malo, pero es una forma de vida.
People, they glorify these guys. They see them as their heroes, you know. That's basically the story. That's why you see, that's why narco culture has grown so much, because these guys see narcos as a modern-day Robin Hood.
So that is the voice, that last voice we heard, one of the actors from this narco film that
yes.
was being shot. Shaul Schwartz, the director of the documentary film Narco Cultura, about the drug culture of Mexico, its unanticipated, perhaps, seepage into American pop culture, these narco corridos. You know, this band, Bucanas de Culiacan, they're playing not just in California, they're playing in Atlanta and in Texas and all over the place, and selling records at Walmart. Now, the juxtaposition is one of the most striking things. Here is this guy living in California, sort of idolizing this drug culture from a distance, juxtaposed with Richie Soto, who is one of the CSI, one of the crime scene investigators, who his job, their job is so dangerous, they go out in masks. They're the guys out on the streets and, you know,
correct.
With their faces covered.
Yes, we spend a lot of time with, that is a prime juxtaposition of the two stories of the film, a singer who glorifies versus a CSI worker. And we spend a couple of years there, and in 1 year, four CSI workers from a unit of 26, mind you, get whacked, get killed while we're there.
While you're there. And this is in Juarez.
This is in Ciudad Juarez in 210, which at that time is not only the most dangerous city in this conflict, it's presumably the most dangerous city in the world. And all this happens across, literally across from El Paso, though we would fly in from New York and walk across the bridge. El Paso at that time is the safest city in the U.S. It has 5 murders. Juarez that year has more than 3,600 murders.
And that's up from 300 murders in 2006. So your film sort of, it's a disturbing progression from 2006 to 2007, where it goes from 300 something to 1,500 something, but then it just keeps going up and
it
up.
It just keeps going. It goes 1,000% up in 3 years. And that is because this is a turf war, essentially, and it happens all in different places in Mexico. And it starts on a particular day, pretty much, and then it just gets more and more and more. And it completely spins out of control. But what's interesting about Richie Soto and the crime scene unit is how methodical they do their job. I initially, as a photographer, I went in there because I thought, wow, this is a great way to get into this very hard position to film in and also get out because these guys pick up every body. But what becomes much more interesting really quickly is Richie and his colleagues seem to do their job extremely well, yet over 97% of the crimes do not get investigated. The files they are writing so carefully never get opened.
Yeah.
And it's shocking to see someone kind of, Richie is third generation Juarez. He loves his city. He's almost like this naive puppy kind of saying, don't worry, I'm going to try and make this better. It's just a little bit of a bad time. And I think through the progression of the film, he, to put it in his own words, understands his place in the system.
Hmm.
And that's a place of fear. And that, to me, was also, the name is narcocultura, which means narcoculture, because there's this huge culture of fear and impunity and intimidation that runs. And when you understand that, you know, at a certain point, the head of Richie's unit is blamed for working at the Sinaloa cartel. All this, by the way, on a narco blog, which makes him eventually resign as his life is in danger. And when you understand that people really believe, and we always did too, that the cartels are infiltrated everywhere, the unit, the hotel we stay in, the 7-Eleven downstairs, your bathroom, literally. Then you understand that, yeah, Richie's not corrupt himself. He wants good. He wants to save his city. But would you do your job all that good if you're not sure who else in the 26 people is working for who?
Yeah. So you're riding along with him. You're riding along with Edgar from this Narco Corridos band. And then eventually, Edgar does get to visit Mexico. And you're tooling around with these guys as well. This must have been pretty... How scared were you? You were in some dangerous positions.
I was very... I mean, I'm a photojournalist and a conflict photographer at heart, so to a degree it's in my DNA. I'm a 20-year veteran of doing this. But this story was a little bit different because usually you embed or you kind of know which side you trust. Even in places I've been, such as Afghanistan and Gaza, and the list is long, it wasn't such a mind game of who is who and what's going on. So we did expect Juarez to be a dangerous scene, and it was, but to some extent, the absolutely last scene we shot on this film was going down with Edgar and Bucanas to Culiacan, Sinaloa, the heartland of the Sinaloa cartel. And Edgar connects there with traffickers, with bigger up traffickers this time. And this is kind of where he really gets, if you will, to play himself narco a little bit for a couple of days. For us, imagine me after 4.5 years of covering this and seeing so much horrific stuff. Yet you never really, when you're in Juarez, when you're in these kind of places, you know the traffickers are everywhere, but you never know who it is. Nobody ever raises his hand and say, well, it's me.
Yeah.
Everybody's always scared. Everybody knows it's around, but it's like this ghost you don't see. But what happens to us in Culiacan is surprisingly, if you will, through a band, not through the real life, quote unquote, we slip in and now we're in their convoys. we have this access that very few journalists had, and certainly not with a film camera in their hand, to the actual people. And it was short. It was scary. We shot more than we could put out there. And we saw a lot more. But we go to a private party. We see the meth labs. We see the infamous graveyard of the big celebrated traffickers. And
with their mausoleums.
Million-dollar bulletproof mausoleums. They get buried with their pickup trucks and so not. And that's kind of, I think, it sounds so shocking now, but I think as you go through the progression of the film, it makes, by then you really get how much this is ingrained in everyday life.
And people actually do look to these guys for protection, too.
Oh, absolutely. They're the force that runs the show, if you will.
And another of the compelling people you speak to is this journalist, Sandra Rodriguez, from the paper El Diario, who basically picks up on that theme.
For me, it's like a symptom of how defeated we are as a society. The kids want to look like narcos. What I think is because they represent an idea of success and power and impunity and limitless power.
Transcurrieron los años, hoy soy un sicario, trabajo en la línea del Chapo y del Mayo. Soy gente bravera, muy trabajadora, me mantengo alerta.
So we heard Sandra Rodriguez, journalist from El Diario, and then a little bit of, this is one of Edgar's songs.
It's El Compa 300, The Friend 300.
And 300 being a pretty high level.
Yes,
member.
300 was, well, he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
300 was, as the song says, was a famous hitman that runs what they call a commando of hitmans for the Sinaloa cartel. Mm-hmm. 300 met Edgar again after a show, and this song was brought to life.
So he commissioned a song about himself from Edgar and his band. And we see Edgar going on YouTube and watching a video of 300 and his men shooting,
out in the desert, shooting
guns up in the air as a tribute to him. Right,
yeah,
a shout out
to Edgar and thanking him for the song.
So now, since you made this movie, this guy 300 has died. What about? I'm almost afraid to ask. What about Richie Soto?
Richie's fine. Richie is. Alive and happy. He still works as a CSI unit in Juarez. And he had plans and ideas of moving to El Paso with his then-girlfriend. They broke up, and Richie does what I thought he would do, which is stay close to home.
And Edgar, having actually gone into the maw of the Sinaloa cartel and met these guys and come back, do you detect any difference in his songwriting?
You know, I think Edgar, through the making of the film, I kind of wanted to see if Edgar would have more of a conscience about what he's doing. I understand that he loves what he does. I understand even that he himself says, look, I'm a product of reality. This is what I sell entertainment. And to Edgar's defense, I do want to say his lines are clear, although they don't seem so much, but he knows when to call it day, what he doesn't do, what he does do. I heard Edgar saying in some interviews that he wants to stop writing corridos. That confused me because I didn't feel that was the case. I think seeing the movie about a month ago, he saw the movie a couple of times in the making, but he saw it with his family and friends in a LA Latino Film Festival about a month ago. And I think that was a hard experience because I think the mirror was really put up for him. But at the end of the day, Edgar is proud of what he does. To some degree, I would say the music is his savior. If he wasn't doing this, he might have well be on the other side, to be honest.
And where he had been before. He had been in
where
jail
he had
earlier.
Been before.
So Edgar's band, Bucanas de Culiacan, continuing to make their narco corridos. Charles, it is, I said horrifying before, but it is horrifying, but also really gripping and important viewing. So thank you very much for making it and for sharing it with us on Soundcheck today.
Thanks for having me.
Voy a recordar a un compa.
La banda va a amenizar. Que retumbe la tambora.
The film Narcocultura is now available on Netflix and Amazon. And since our conversation with filmmaker Shaul Schwartz in 2013, the head of the Sinaloa cartel, one of the most wanted men in the world, El Chapo Guzman, has been captured by Mexican authorities. That does it for today's show. Remember, you can explore our archives of live performances and interviews on soundcheck.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Soundcheck to get the latest updates about live webcasts, music news, and more. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Dan O'Donnell, and Mike Katziff with Amy Pearl. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.